So, if you remember from yesterday, we talked about thermality, and thermality is it's a notion that comes from the laws of thermodynamics, in particular from the zeroth law and the second law. And we talked a little bit about the notion of Gibbs thermality, which tells like, well, if entropy can only increase or stay the same under spontaneous processes, and reaching equilibrium is basically letting a system undergo spontaneous processes until it reaches a stationary state, then thermality has to be, for a fixed amount of energy, has to be whatever state that maximizes entropy. Then we talked about the quantum version, if you want, directly inherited from the canonical ensemble, the quantum version of the condition of thermality, of the Gibbs thermality. And then we talked about that being not well defined for quantum fields. So you cannot have Gibbs kind of thermal states for quantum fields. And how do we deal with that? And then we talked about the KMS condition. The KMS condition is a generalization, as we will prove today, is a generalization of KMS thermality. It's a generalization of Gibbs thermality, in particular that defines thermality talking about objects that are arguably more fundamental than things like entropy or even states of a theory. So today, because these are the objects you build quantum field theory out of when you formulate quantum field theory axiomatically. So today we're going to prove a couple things, three things, if you want. First, we're going to prove that the KMS condition implies stationarity. Obviously, that's a necessary condition for thermality. We know thermal states are equilibrium states, so better be stationary. And we will also prove that, in like full words, if you want, whenever the canonical ensemble can be defined, then Gibbs thermality is equivalent to KMS thermality. All right? OK. Any questions about yesterday or any notion that we talked about yesterday? We also said that there are two. The KMS condition is actually two conditions, if you want. One, a condition of holomorphicity on the complex extension, if you want, of the two-point correlator. So they have to be boundary values of a complex function that are holomorphic in a strip of the complex plane. And the second, which is the one that's usually known as the KMS condition, is what we call complex antiperiodicity in imaginary time. OK? All right. So stationarity. OK. Let's prove that KMS implies stationarity. Well, that's not too difficult. So let's take condition 2. For the particular case where A is the identity. Look at what I'm doing here, though, because I'm being a bit cheeky. I told you that A and B have to be bounded operators, and then I'm picking the identity, which for finite dimensions is a bounded operator. Is it for infinite dimensions? Yes, but you need a little bit more of machinery. So I would need the spectral theorem here. Obviously, the identity is a bounded operator, as in like if you have a vector of finite norm and you apply the identity, it's still finite norm. But again, to write it like properly, you need a little bit more of what I wrote. But obviously, well, I mean, we agree, all of us, that the identity is a bounded operator, right? So it's fine. It's within the rules. OK, so doing that, the condition 2 becomes the following. Expectation of beta tau plus I beta on rho, it's equal to the expectation of b tau of rho on rho. OK. So this is a periodicity condition. This is telling me that this two-point correlator is periodic in imaginary time. And in particular, this implies that B of I tau on rho, it's equal to B 0 on rho. All right. So let's write Schwarz inequality for this function. That tells me that the modulus of the expectation of B of Z on rho is less or equal than the norm of B Z like that, where the norm I take to be the trace norm. And here's assuming because there's other, I'm going a little bit fast in terms of the assumptions that I'm taking, because this operator, this would be true for trace class operator. When I write the norm in here, the norm is not guaranteed, so if the operator is bounded, it's not guaranteed to be trace class. The opposite is also true, meaning like if it's trace class, it's not guaranteed to be bounded. So let me take B an operator that is trace class, or any operator that is trace class. I can generalize this, but let me just not to get into much details on that one because we have a finite amount of time. So let's assume that this thing exists. And then this is equal to B, of course, of, if you want, x plus iy. And this is equal to the norm of e to the I h x b I y e to the minus I h x. But this is a unitary, this is x is real, so this is a unitary operator. So the norm is not modified by this. This is the norm b I y. Okay. So what this is telling me is that the modulus of B of Z on rho, it's bounded by, right, it's bounded by, let me just write it here, this modulus of B Z on rho, it's bounded by M equals the max of the norm of B I y in the interval 0 beta. Okay? In the on the strip, of course. 0 imaginary Z beta. All right. So, right. So what we know then is that this thing is periodic, and here's the trick, right? This thing is periodic, and if it is periodic, yeah, exactly. So exactly. So this thing, BZ, is periodic. And so periodic because of this result. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, indeed. It doesn't really matter as much, but yes. Yeah. You're so right. BZ is periodic and holomorphic. So periodic because of condition one, and holomorphic because of condition two in the strip, in the strip 0 imaginary Z beta. Okay, so because it's periodic, then if B of Z is bounded on the strip, then it's bounded everywhere. see. And now this may look a little bit redundant because I already said here that B has to be bounded, right? But it's certainly not redundant. Because when I said it's a bounded operator, this B, I was talking about B of tau, which is an operator evaluated at real parameter tau. Now I'm proving that B of Z, the analytical extension, well, the extension to the complex plane of B, is also bounded, which was not proven. It's not part of the hypothesis, the original one. All right, so yeah, B of Z is bounded everywhere in C. And then we just have that Liouville theorem says that B of Z, right, is bound on rho, of course, bounded and holomorphic, then it has to be what? What does it have to be? What does Liouville theorem tell us? I know you know. Constant. I know you know. Yeah?
Constant.
Constant. Has to be on rho, of course. Constant. And therefore, now we are saying that this thing has to be equal to the expectation at zero. And in particular, if you take Z equals just tau, the real one, you get stationarity for all expectations of all observables. And you can build any observable you want, just multiplying whatever you want. You can give all the endpoint functions, all the probability distribution if you want, just taking your B as product of observables. All right, so then we have stationarity. Questions? Yes?
Can you prove that the expectation value is bounded?
Yes.
But you assume that the operator is bounded itself?
No, we assume the operator is bounded, B of Z, but I also proved here that B of tau is bounded by hypothesis. The KMS condition is defined on bounded operators. But this is B of tau. I don't know what B of Z is. You see, B of Z is so far is a holomorphic function. Well, B of Z, in fact, what I went with is I defined these functions. These functions that are functions of Z, that are expectation values of A0, BZ on rho. And those things are functions that are holomorphic on a strip so that they are the boundary values of those functions in the real line and in zero are these. So this tells you nothing about, in principle, about B hat of Z, which is what is this operator B when you extend it to the complex plane. I know that B of tau being real, is bounded. I have no idea what B of Z is, what if it's bounded or not. I prove that it is, though. I mean, we do have an idea, but we need to prove it. It's not trivial from there.
So how do you know that M is finite?
Say again?
How do you know that M is finite?
Oh, because of Schwarz theorem, right? If you assume that this thing is trace class, if your operator that you pick is trace class, then this thing is bounded. Trace class, well, I write it here. Trace class means that this is finite. If you want. That's what it means to be trace class. Always trace class if that is true. In particular, if this thing has a trace, O has a trace in itself, that implies that the trace is finite. Yeah?
In the second line, you said this thing on the left is less than or equal to the absolute value evaluated at the imaginary part of Z, right? That's what
yeah.
Y is. But then on the third line, you say that this is true for any Y in the range 0 to beta. How do you make that step?
I'm using Schwarz here. So here's the thing. So this thing is, what we had is that this thing is imaginary periodic, so on the strip. We know it in the strip is bounded trace class by assumption, and then we know it's periodic. So everywhere in the complex plane would be bounded by whatever bounds it in the first strip, because it's just periodic as you go up. All right, yeah. Many subtleties in this, though, and I'm going relatively fast, so I appreciate these questions. All right. So what we got is that the KMS condition implies stationarity, as in, like, we define a stationary state if all the expectation values of all the observables are not time-dependent, which is what you are getting here, with the caveat for this proof that I gave you that I'm assuming trace class for B. You don't need to. You can actually prove it properly, but let's define here stationarity for all the observables. Like, if you had a theory in the usual sense, meaning like you have a free field theory, for example, then you would take, if all observables represented by trace class operators are stationary, the expectation, all the endpoint functions, then the state is stationary. But again, this takes some more proving that I'm not doing here today. But at least this gives you a hint. All right. This is true, by the way, whether the canonical ensemble can be defined or not. Okay, this is stationarity. It's independent of the fact, because of course, if you prove that is one-to-one with Gibbs, when Gibbs is well-defined, that implies also stationarity. Okay? But this is also true when Gibbs cannot be defined. Gibbs normality cannot be defined. All right, so let's go with the following. Let's prove that KMS implies, let's start with Gibbs implies KMS because it's more difficult. All right, let's prove this. All right, so let rho be a Gibbs state of inverse temperature beta. All right, so that means, of course, that rho you can write at 1 over the partition function exponential of minus beta h. That's what it means to be a Gibbs state. All right, so again, the assumption here is that Gibbs states exist, something that, as we discussed yesterday, is not true in quantum field theory. But in the cases where you can well define the canonical ensemble and you have no problems with a partition function, then that would be a Gibbs state. All right, so let's check first that Gibbs implies one, condition one in here. All right, so the operator A 0 B tau plus I, did I call it sigma? Yeah, I did call it sigma. Sigma rho equals, let's just substitute rho, and then you get A of 0 E minus sigma H B tau E to the minus B minus sigma H divided by Z of beta. So my claim is that is trace class for 0 sigma beta. Oh, that's a lot to say, though. Like, is it guaranteed that it's trace class? Well, assumptions that go into that. Let me assume that H is bounded from below, and let's take that bound to be 0. So that H is a positive operator, or at least not negative operator. And then if you do that, then we know that this thing here is trace class. This thing here is bounded. This thing here is bounded. Then this thing here is trace class. The first one, this one is trace class, so let's go trace class, bounded, trace class. The first one is trace class because of the demand that sigma only goes to 0, and this one because it doesn't go over beta. Okay? Now, the product of trace class and bounded is bounded. Sorry, it's trace class. You people agree with that? If not, let me just give you where to see it. So the product of a bounded and a trace class operator is trace class. And if you want to see that, you can see Reed and Simon section 6, which is called, by the way, bounded operators. And in particular, to see it, this is exercises 27 and 28. So in fact, exercises 27 and 28 tell you prove this and prove this. So taking the result of those exercises, the thing that you have to prove together, you can prove easily that the product of bounded and trace class is trace class. And I don't know anywhere else where they do that. You know Reed Simon's, people? It's a good book. It's kind of the book that if you want to learn functional analysis, maybe Reed Simon is the book that you have to have next to you on your desk. Not maybe the book that you used to learn, but the book to actually check things properly. Reed and Simon are like the book where people do things properly in functional analysis. It's a good book to consult things. Anyway, so the product of bounded and trace class is trace class, so this thing is trace class, which is nice. So that means, if it's trace class, then that means the following. That in 0 imaginary offset beta, we have that A of 0, the offset on rho, is the trace of A of 0, B of Z rho. So you see, this is something that probably if I had written without giving you any more text, you would have been OK with, right? Agreed, everyone? But keep in mind that the reason I'm being careful with that is because the KMS condition goes to the fundamentals of the quantum theory you're considering. Remember that in quantum field theory, we can just do away with states, do away with everything, and talk only about the endpoint functions. The correlators is what's actually fundamental in a quantum field theory when you go axiomatic on the quantum field theory. So writing this has to be proven that you can. Okay? You cannot just define the expectation at that. Okay? Because maybe the operators you're considering, they're bounded, but they may not be trace class. Again, if you were in finite dimensions, of course, they're always bounded and trace class. If they are observables, they would be also trace class. But you know, in general, you don't know that. But still, you can write this, which is neat. Okay? If you have Gibbs, the only thing that you need is Gibbs, then A and B may not be trace class, but still, you can write this. OK? All right, so is a well-defined function of Z. And then it's trivial to say, it's trivial to see, you can substitute. Remember, this B, you can substitute as, where do I have it? As this. And rho, you can substitute it as this. And it's easy to check that this function satisfies Cauchy-Riemann. All right, so basically, writing Z equals to tau plus I, this is tau plus I sigma, then it's trivial to prove by substitution that partial tau of this function, let's call this thing F of Z, okay? So this thing of F is equal to minus I partial sigma of F. just by substitution. It's very easy. I mean, you can tell already when you substitute in what you're going to get. You get the tau from the time evolution and the sigma from this sigma from the time. If you want sigma from the imaginary part of time evolution, tau from the real part, the difference is an I, so you satisfy Cauchy-Riemann. So, therefore, this thing, A0, B z on rho, is holomorphic in the strip. There you go. And then again, you can do the analogous construction for the other one. So we proved that Gibbs implies KMS1. Questions? I'm being a bit fast because I want to do other things too, but please do stop me. If this is the kind of thing that in physics people usually don't do, because it's like being careful with what you're defining, what you have to. If you claim, so you see, why am I being careful with this? Or at least trying to be careful with this? Because I'm claiming to you that you're not going to be able to write Gibbs in general for field theory. And the reasons you cannot write Gibbs in general in field theory are the same reasons why you have to be careful when you write these kinds of expressions. OK? So otherwise, it wouldn't be consistent if I wouldn't do that much amount of care. Questions? All right. That one's broken, by the way. It doesn't move. The left side doesn't move at all. So that's unfortunate. I'm going to have to erase today. All right. Now, let's prove that Gibbs implies 2. All right, so let's take the boundary value. Well, I'm not going to write it. I'm going to just do it, and you'll see it. Right. So beta of tau equals e to the I h tau b of 0 e to the minus I h tau. OK, then extending tau to the complex plane. Writing as a physicist a bit here. And then beta tau plus I beta, sorry, beta, B of tau plus I beta, it's equal to e to the I h. And of course, you write here tau plus I beta, then B of 0, then e to the minus I h tau plus I beta. OK. So now we compute this thing, a of 0, b tau plus I beta, rho. On rho, which of course we can substitute as the trace of, because we already proved that we can do that, the trace of a of 0. And then I'm going to write everything here, e to the I h beta, right, b of tau, e, minus beta, right, minus beta h, b of tau, e to beta h, right, and then e to the minus beta h divided by z of beta. So what did I do here? What I did is, well, I wrote the left-hand side as this first. I substituted in the Gibbs state. And I also substituted in, well, this thing, of course, take the imaginary part of this, which it becomes real, so exponential of minus beta on the left, exponential of plus beta on the right, and just separate it in here. Agreed, everyone? All right, so now we use the cyclic property of the trace, and we get that this is equal to the trace of b of tau, a of 0, e to the minus beta h, divided by set of beta. Oh, nice, but this thing is, so all that I did here is cancel these two exponentials and then move these two things to the other side, okay? And then, the beta to the other side. And then I realize that this thing is, again, the row that we had. And then we can write that this is the trace of B of tau, A of zero, rho, which, again, because we proved that one is satisfied, we can write as the expectation of B tau, A of zero, rho. Well, there we go. This thing equals this thing. We made it. Complex antiperiodicity proved. All right, so that ends the left to right part of the proof, implies KMS. So if you have the canonical ensemble can be defined and you have a Gibbs state, then it automatically satisfies the KMS condition as stated on this board. Questions? It was a bit fast, but these are just simple calculations. Yes?
When you say the canonical ensemble can be well defined, is that equivalent to saying?
The partition function exists and is finite.
Is that saying that e to the minus beta h is trace class?
Yep, it's the same thing. All of those things are the same thing. All right. Now, let's prove that Gibbs implies KMS. KMS implies Gibbs. That's a very simple one, or simpler, anyways. All right, so let's assume in this case that rho is KMS. And then condition two at tau equals zero implies that the trace of A of zero exponential minus BH B at zero commutator with E beta H rho is zero. So all that I did here is get the complex antiperiodicity, particularize with tau is zero, okay? And use the linearity of the trace, put this thing on the left-hand side. And put everything under the same trace. Okay? Agreed, everyone? So you get AB positive, BA negative inside the trace. That's the commutator. Agreed, people? Oh, also, write this beta as the generated by the Hamiltonian. Okay? So we get that statement. So do you people, everyone agrees with that? That's just is if you want arithmetics on condition two here. Greet everyone. It's not magic or anything. All right, cool. And that's true for any bounded operator A. Okay, cool. So if this is true for any bounded operator A, then what we know from here is that then the only way that's going to be zero for any A is if the commutator itself is zero. Agreed, people? Agreed, everyone? So we get that B of zero commutator with E to the beta H rho is equal to zero. All right, but this is true again for any bounded operator B, right? Well, if this has to be true for any bounded operator B, the only possibility is that this thing is what? What kind of thing commutes with everything? Or with any bounded operator, if you want. Yeah, tell me, you know it.
Identity.
The identity, indeed. So E beta H rho is proportional to the identity. Okay? Well, if you normalize, if this thing is trace class, then that means that rho is then 1 over the trace of, well, let's just write it, set beta exponential of beta h, where set beta is the trace of exponential of beta h. All right, so we have a Gibbs state. So when we have KMS thermality, we have Gibbs thermality automatically. All right, so these two proofs, if you want, tell you that Gibbs and KMS, when Gibbs is well-defined, are the same thing, which is kind of cool. Yeah?
At one point, exactly, did you assume that Gibbs is well-defined in this?
Oh, yeah, the point where I write a state that has a set of beta here, and I say that makes sense.
But the part where the state is proportional to e to the minus beta h is valid,
yeah, but the state might not be well defined. So that's the point. Like, if I tell you that this has to be proportional to identity and this thing is not normalizable, it's not a state. That's the whole point. We've been rigorous with these things. So no, it's not a state unless this thing is normalizable. So unless this thing is trace class, that's not a state. So that's where we assume that this thing has to be. So the assumption, if you want to write this, is that this thing is trace class, which is the same as Gibbs can be defined. All right, so. This is already interesting in its own right, because it's kind of like, even if you don't have any problems with Gibbs thermality, you say, oh, cool. So being thermal kind of implies that we have this funny property of all the possible correlators that you can have. All the possible correlators that you can have are periodic when you let time be imaginary, right? That's a very neat property, and it's connected with many, many things that you have seen in, I don't know, in all the variants of field theory that you've seen everywhere. There's an amount of things that I haven't proven, if you want. Like, for example, hold on. Can I do the same thing assuming that h would be time dependent? Why did you just write it like this? Can't I have a parameter dependence on h? And the answer is yes, you can. But then you quickly dismiss it because you can prove that it's stationary. And to be stationary implies that h cannot be time dependent. Okay, the Hamiltonian needs to commute with the state if the state is well defined. All right. So, any questions? Time dependent, I mean, it can still be time dependent, but it needs to commute with itself at all times and so on. And then you can also prove that it won't be time dependent when you do that. I mean, I'm just missing steps here. Questions? Yeah, sorry, I want to be precise, and I'm basically probably making it even a little bit more confusing. But any questions about this? All right, so I need to erase. Now, we have discussed, where do I do this? Let's see. We have discussed that this is true for all bounded operators, A and B. Now, let me give you a version of this that is particularly useful for quantum field theory. How many bounded operators do you usually handle when you work with quantum field theories and observables in quantum field theories? Usually not many, right? All right. So let's see how this goes. So KMS also implies the following on the two-point correlators. The two-point correlator, let me call it W on rho of tau prime equals, by definition, A of tau prime. Right? Well, this is a definition. This is what we call the two-point correlator of the observable A. Agreed? I'm calling it W because of reasons that you probably already imagine. Anyway, so then KMS implies the following three conditions on the correlator. Stationarity. which means that W rho of tau tau prime, it's equal to W rho of 0 delta tau, time translational invariance, which usually we abbreviate as delta tau in there. Of course, with delta tau, it's just tau prime minus tau. Holomorphicity. Of W rho delta tau, or W of Z, if you want, in the upper strip, 0, imaginary of Z, imaginary of, sorry, beta, and also complex antiperiodicity. Of period beta, which tells me that W rho of delta tau plus I beta, it's equal to W rho of minus delta tau. This just comes from taking B to be A. All right. So these things are, of course, consequences of the KMS condition. And still, the assumption is that A is a bounded operator. Now, in general, the translation to quantum field theory of how this condition is applied, and let's see what's going on. Now, in a QFT, a state rho is KMS, again, with respect to translations on tau of inverse temperature beta, if and only if, and I'm not writing this, and I'm going to do quotes, and we're going to get into discussing the quotes, the following is true. So, W, let's call these guys 1, 2, and 3. W rho of T, oh, if you want, x of tau, x of tau prime. Okay, so which is defined as, if you want, the expectation of the field operator on x, well, this is a particular definition for a scalar field, but x of, if you want, t of tau, x of tau, sorry, just t of tau prime, x of tau prime, rho satisfies 1, 2, and 3. So let's see what I wrote here. What I wrote here is what we saw was, is that a question? Yeah.
What is this word line we seem to be?
Say again?
What is this word line we seem to be assuming exists?
We're going to get to that. So let me just give you a statement, and then let's discuss why that's true. Okay. So let's understand the ingredients in this line that I wrote. I wrote here the Weidman function of the field, agreed, the two-point Weidman function, evaluated along the trajectory. So x of tau is the trajectory, the word line, generated by partial tau. OK? So it's the trajectory such that the parameter tau to define the KMS condition is the proper time for that trajectory. Agreed, people? This is just a definition. Okay? So what this line is telling me, if that were true, and we will get there, it's telling me that a state of the field rho is KMS with respect to time tau if the pullback of the Wyman function on the trajectory that is associated with proper time tau satisfies stationarity, so time translational invariant with respect to tau, holomorphicity in the complex plane, in the strip of the complex plane, and the antiperiodicity condition. Is that the statement? We will discuss why that's true now. This is the thing. But is the statement understood? It's a much weaker statement than in terms of how stringent it is than the full KMS condition. Problems with that, to begin with. So first obvious problem. Who can point out problems, though? First obvious problem. I'm using the same operator here, whereas here I'm supposed to that be true for any two bounded operators. Second problem, the word bounded here. Field operators here. These field operators are not bounded in general. Even if you localize them, if you construct a local algebra of observables, those things are not bounded. Agreed, people? All right, so these things, to actually prove that KMS implies that, you need to prove several things. You need to first prove that in your theory, you can define what is called quasi-free states. Have you heard those words before? Quasi-free is what in quantum optics, for example, would be called Gaussian states. Gaussian states are those states that are fully defined by the two-point function. Well, and the first point, and the one-point function, if you want. The mean and the the standard deviation. But that's what they call Gaussians. Like Gaussians, they are defined through the first and second moments. Now, if you have quasi-free states, Gaussian states, then you can prove that KMS states, with the definition of KMS states for bounded operators and so on, have to be Gaussian, have to be quasi-free. Once you prove that, then you say, for Gaussian states, I can build the following. I can build the Weyl algebra, and the Weyl algebra is building out of operators that are not bounded, you build bounded operators. And you've done that all the time. If you've taken in your quantum field theory, you've done like Wilson loops and things like that, you are doing that. When you're constructing, you have an algebra, a local algebra of observables. Say that you have localized field operators in a point or in a region, if you want everything to be well-defined with some weight. Then you can take the exponentials of those operators and then construct out of something that is not bounded an operator that is bounded. And that algebra is the Weyl algebra. I'm being very rough here, but that's how you construct it. And then if you can prove that the Weyl algebra is a full algebra, so it generates all the operators, all the translations that you want in the group, in the supergroup of the field, then you can prove that for the Weyl algebra, the KMS condition, which actually is well-defined because those are bounded operators, implies this condition if and only if for Gaussian states, for quasi-free states. And we also prove on a parallel note, if you want, that the states for which the KMS condition is satisfied are quasi-free. And that's the way it goes. And this is a long proof. A long proof, I mean, there's one paper that does it. Citing other papers, this is like a 50 pages kind of paper. And the reason is you need to go theorem, lemma, apply. So it's non-trivial. So it's the kind of thing that mathematicians would call non-trivial, meaning like it takes a while to prove it. Okay? And I'm not going to do it in this course, but just so you know. So what I've given you is KMS. This is definitely rigorous. This is the definition of the KMS condition. Then we have proven that Gibbs and KMS are equivalent whenever Gibbs is well-defined. And in particular, for a quantum field theory that Gibbs is not well-defined, we have a shorter version, if you want, of KMS. First, we realize that KMS implies this. OK, that's true. There's nothing particular or tricky about this. And then I'm telling you that you can prove that the KMS condition can be made equivalent to a condition on the Wyman function. On the Wyman function, pull back to the trajectory generated by tau, the parameter with respect to which the thing is thermal. Any questions? This was a dense class. Any questions? Now, if there's any pure mathematician in the room, if you're offended or anything, please let me know. I would love to hear. Questions? Yes?
What's the relationship between the KMS approach to thermal QFTs and other approaches like Matsubara formalism or double?
It's super strong. So the Matsubara formalism, to define it well and to be well defined, is relying on the KMS condition, that the state is KMS thermal. It's exactly the same thing. The way it's usually done is the way that how physicists handle the KMS condition without caring too much about the algebraic considerations that are underground, you know, like the kind of things that is basically user level working with KMS thermality. Kubo and Matsubara, I mean, it's the same school, if you want. Like, the person who first came up with this and Matsubara are related by a one generation kind of teacher and student kind of thing. So. Anyway, so this is big, though. Don't get me wrong. This is, we're not going to get into that. But this is big, because this allows you to talk about thermality without waving hands, as in like, OK, look, quantum field theory is plagued with problems, and we know that. Even free theories, which is the ones that we kind of know how to do things, are plagued with problems. For example, the exponentials of Hamiltonians are not trace class. Thermality you cannot be defined in the usual way. Sometimes we do tricks, regularization, limits. People doing pure math, the same people, or the, I guess, the descendants, intellectual descendants of the people, like von Neumann, the people, you remember how quantum mechanics started? Not remember as in you were alive, but remember as in having studied it. Quantum mechanics starts with many things that don't make much sense, beginning with Planck, crazy things. And then Planck makes an outrageous statement about how things should work, right? It's like, well, if we want this to reproduce the black body radiation, then we need to assume these things that are kind of unreasonable, but it's what it is. And then other people look into that, and there are consequences of that. And those consequences are outrageous. And then people start doing physics with it and postulating things. And then von Neumann arrives to the picture, and von Neumann says, well, hold on, what are you doing here? What the heck? This is, what are you doing? Let's take a step back and do this rigorously. And this is the modern quantum mechanics we study. Like, von Neumann arrives, fixes the mess that people were doing, kind of user-level kind of mess, fixes the mess and says, look, in these cases, you don't get this because you cannot talk about the trace of this, but then you can do it like this and that. And this is quantum mechanics as we know it. Now, in quantum field theory, it's kind of starting the game again. Now, you do what is called second quantization, if you want, when you do canonical quantum field theory. And problems all the way. And then we have the best prediction we ever had in physics in terms of matching significant figures with QED. And then we take that out of a second order expansion of a series we know, not we suspect, we know is divergent. Oh yeah, but don't sum 12 terms, sum 2, and you get the right result. 12 is just goes out of the window. If you do it, you can do it, and you get like something that doesn't make sense. But the two first predict experiments like with the best precision ever. And then people are like, all right, what is this mess? What's going on here? And then people like Weidman and other people, started looking at this in a different way. You have other problems, right? People talk about particles all the time, phenomenology in particle physics, and then you get a theorem by Malamand that says, oh, by the way, the notion of particle, the notion of localization, and relativity are mutually incompatible. You need to relax one of them. And things like that, the theory has many problems. When you talk about localization in a relativistic system, you face many problems. Then there are people like Weidman and others. Weidman must have been something amazing to talk to. In all those papers of algebraic quantum field theory, sometimes there are statements that are kind of conjectures, and there's a citation, and the citation says, Weidman, private communication. So when that is there, people usually give it the value of theorem, even if they don't know the proof. Because usually, if Weidman said it, it's probably true. Anyway, just a joke. It's true, though. You will find those things. So those people are like, OK, let's do quantum field theory axiomatically, as in, like, let's be as careful as von Neumann and company were with quantum mechanics, but with quantum field theory. And then they start saying that talking about states is a mess. Talking about the vacuum state of a theory, what the heck? That doesn't make any sense. That, I don't understand that, you know? And then they say, OK, hold on. Instead of talking about states, let's talk about endpoint functions. Let's talk about these objects. Let's define the theory through these objects, through the correlations on observables, which is, on the one hand, mathematically nice. It allows you to postulate, to axiomatize quantum field theory. On the other hand, it's strongly connected with experiments. I plan in the next lecture, this was kind of a pure math-oriented kind of lecture, but the next lecture is going to be about, let's do experiments with particle detectors with freaking atoms moving through space-time and see what they see of the field. And we will see that these objects are fundamental from the observational point of view. This is the physics. These objects encode the physics. So algebraic quantum field theory, let's not be, so I'm kind of selling it to you. Let's be realistic. There are only a few things that you can do. And the reason is it gets complicated, very easy, very fast. But that said, with the usual quantum field theory, there's only a few things. It's not that we can do. It's not that the kind of things that we can do with the usual formulations of field theory are huge, and the things that you can do with algebraic are a zero measure set. No, they're comparable. You can do a few more. But when you get into interaction theories, you're screwed, no matter how you do it. With this, at least you can formulate it properly, and you can talk about cases when it makes sense. So I hope, and this is the last thing I'll tell you today, I hope in this course, the philosophy I want is like, we look back to formulations of quantum field theory that are safe, as in like axiomatized and safe, everything is well defined, and then we're gonna try to connect that with what people do in terms of like user level quantum field theory and experiments, all right? So the next lecture that I'm going to talk about here in the next lecture is like, well, you told me, sir, KMS generalizes Gibbs, as we proved. But is it kind of uselessly generalizing Gibbs? As in like, OK, it's Gibbs when it's Gibbs, and it's 42 elsewhere. Or is it really something that makes sense? The next thing that we're going to do is we're going to take a particle detector. That particle detector, of course, will be undergoing some trajectory in space-time. They will have a proper time that you can associate to the center of mass of that particle detector. And then that particle detector is going to couple to the field, and we're going to see if this particle detector thermalizes. So what happens with it? If the state is a KMS state, hopefully the detector, which is, in our case, a simple two-level system, two-level quantum system, the detector is a finite-dimensional system, meaning that all the observables are finite-dimensional. They are bounded and trace class. You can define Gibbs thermality. You can talk about the Gibbs temperature of the detector. Hopefully, if the KMS thermality makes sense for fields, when you stick a thermometer to the field and you wait enough time and you are careful about how you couple the detector with the field, we'll see all these subtleties, then you expect that the detector will evolve to a Gibbs thermal state of the same temperature as the KMS temperature of the field. If you do that, then you have phenomenological proof that the KMS thermality is a physical thermality, and the KMS temperature is a physical temperature that characterizes equilibrium in the sense of the zeroth and the second law of thermodynamics. When we are doing KMS thermality with detectors, we will see that there are things that are important. You cannot, if you go to quantum mechanics books or quantum field theory books, oftentimes they write a time evolution operator from T0 to T and things like that. This is not OK. This is harmful. This is not thinking of partial processes that concatenate themselves in time. It's like, yeah, every process you are suddenly switching at T0 and suddenly switching off at T, and there you're doing it concatenating so that all the singular parts of that kind of cancel each other. But that's not a process. So we will talk about what it means to wait for long times. Coupling a detector and waiting for a long time is not innocent. You need something called adiabaticity. To thermalize is complicated. This magic, remember I told you about thermal contact, which is this magic notion that somehow you put two systems to interact and they will evolve to an equilibrium state. And then if you know a little bit of quantum mechanics and try to put a Hamiltonian between them, that won't work. You need to open the system for that to happen, which is funny because I don't remember in the zero law to talk about open systems. So you see, all those issues require care with how detectors couple to the field. You need adiabaticity, and we will see how that plays out and what that it physically means. And the other thing that you need is to realize that this condition here, or the holomorphicity, when you use Matsubara and other formalisms and you talk about thermality, this condition is usually overlooked. This condition is, I would bet you never tested anything. Maybe if you've done anything KMS algebraic from the algebraic point of view or solid state physics where they actually do similar things, you may have. But the holomorphicity condition will be crucial for the detector to actually thermalize. We will see how. It's actually super nice how it comes about. But this holomorphicity is required to do a trick to solve an integral that's the one that yields thermalization. And I think that's going to be pretty neat. Hopefully, we will be connecting this with practical stuff and the stuff of quantum optics, which is kind of the main objective of this part of the course. Anyway, you have things to do today, so this is the end of it. I won't see you probably today in the tutorial, but people will be there. It's going to be fun, hopefully. But be prepared to do calculations in this tutorial. It's about the Andrew effect, so. And I'll see you tomorrow.